Stragos. Yes, let's do it before Stragos decides to push us around some more. I'll have them taken out of storage and brought round in a cart whenever you like. Good. I'll deliver them later this week, then. You mind avoiding the Sin Spire for a night or two? Of course not. Any particular reason? I just want to disappoint Durenna and Corvalur for a bit. Until we're a little more secure with our situation, I'd really prefer not to waste another night losing money and getting drunk. The Bella Paranella trick might rouse suspicion if we pull it again. If you put it that way, I can't say no. How about if I poke around in a few other places and see if I can catch any whispers about the Archon and the Priori? I think we might arm ourselves with a little more of this city's history. Lovely. What the hell's this? They were not alone on the dockside. In addition to occasional strangers hurrying here and there on business, there were boatmen sleeping under cloaks beside their tied-up craft, and a fair number of drunks and derelicts curled up beneath any shelter they could claim. A pile of crates lay just a few paces to their left, and in its shadow sat a thin figure covered in layers of torn rags near a tiny alchemical globe that shone a pale red. The figure clutched a small burlap sack and beckoned to them with one pale hand.
"Sirs! Sirs!"
The loud, croaking voice seemed to be a woman's.
"For pity's sake, you fine gentlemen! For pity's sake! For Perelandro's sake! A coin! Any coin! Thin copper would do! Have pity for Perelandro's sake!"
Locke's hand went to his purse, just inside his frock coat. Jean had taken his coat off and now carried it folded over his right arm. He seemed content to let Locke see to the evening's act of charity. "For Perelandro's sake, madam, you may have more than just a centura." Temporarily distracted by the warm glow of his own affected gallantry, Locke was holding out 3 silver volani before the first little warning managed to register. The beggar would be happy to have 1 thin copper, and had a loud voice. Why hadn't they heard her speaking to any of the strangers who'd passed by just ahead of them? And why was she reaching out with the burlap sack rather than an open hand? Jean was faster than he was, and with no more elegant way to get Locke to safety, he raised his left arm and gave Locke a hard shove. A crossbow bolt punched a neat dark hole in the burlap sack and hissed through the air between them. Locke felt it tug at his coattails as he fell sideways. He toppled over a smaller crate and landed clumsily on his back. He sat up just in time to see Jean kick the beggar in the face. The woman's head snapped back, but she planted her hands on the ground and scissored her legs, sweeping Jean off his feet. As Jean hit the ground and tossed his folded coat away, the beggar drew her legs straight up, kicked them down, and seemed to fling herself forward in an arc. She was on her feet in a second, casting off her rags. Ah, shit, she's a foot boxer, a bloody chassonneur, Locke thought, stumbling to his feet. Jean hates that. Locke twitched his coat sleeves and a stiletto fell into each hand. Moving warily, he skipped across the stones toward Jean's attacker, who was kicking Jean in the ribs as the big man attempted to roll away. Locke was within 3 paces of the chassonneur when the slap of boot leather against the ground warned of a presence close behind him. He raised the stiletto in his right hand as though to strike Jean's assailant, then ducked and whirled, lunging blindly to his rear with the left-hand blade. Locke was instantly glad he'd ducked. Something whirled past his head close enough to tear painfully at his hair. His new attacker was another beggar, a man close to his own stature, and he'd just missed a swing with a long iron chain that would have opened Locke's skull like an egg. The force of the man's attack helped carry him onto the point of Locke's stiletto, which plunged in up to the hilt just beneath the man's right armpit. The man gasped, and Locke pressed his advantage ruthlessly, bringing his other blade down overhand and burying it in the man's left clavicle. Locke wrenched both of his blades as savagely as he could, and the man moaned. The chain slipped from his fingers and hit the stones with a clatter. A second later, Locke worked his blades out of the man's body as though he were pulling skewers from meat, and let the poor fellow slump to the ground. He raised his bloody stilettos, turned, and with a sudden burst of ill-advised self-confidence, charged Jean's assailant. She kicked out from the hip, barely sparing him a glance. Her foot struck his sternum. It felt like walking into a brick wall. He stumbled back, and she took the opportunity to step away from Jean, who looked to have been rather pummeled, and advance on Locke. Her rags were discarded. Locke saw that she was a young woman, probably younger than he was, wearing loose dark clothing and a thin, well-fashioned ribbed leather vest. She was Therin, relatively dark-skinned, with tightly braided black hair that circled her head like a crown. She had a poise that said she'd killed before. No problem, thought Locke as he moved backward. So have I. That's when he tripped over the body of the man he'd just stabbed. She took an instant advantage of his misstep. Just as he regained his balance, she snapped out in an arc with her right leg. Her foot landed like a hammer against Locke's left forearm, and he swore as his stiletto flew from suddenly nerveless fingers. Incensed, he lunged with his right-hand blade. Moving as deftly as Jean ever had, she grabbed his right wrist with her left hand, pulled him irresistibly forward, and slammed the heel of her right hand into his chin. His remaining stiletto whirled into the darkness like a man diving from a tall building, and suddenly the dark sky above him was replaced with looming grey stones. He made their acquaintance hard enough to rattle his teeth like dice in a cup. She kicked him once to roll him over onto his back, then planted a foot on his chest to pin him down. She'd caught one of his blades, and he watched in a daze as she bent forward to put it to use. His hands were numb, traitorously slow, and he felt an unbearable itching sensation on his unprotected neck as his own stiletto dipped toward it. Locke didn't hear Jean's hatchet sink into her back, but he saw its effect and guessed the cause. The woman jerked upright, arched backward, and let the stiletto slip. It clattered against the ground just beside Locke's face, and he flinched. His assailant sank down to her knees just beside him, breathing in swift, shallow gasps, and then twisted away. He could see one of Jean's wicked sisters buried in a spreading dark stain on her lower back, just to the right of her spine. Jean stepped over Locke, reached down and yanked the hatchet from the woman's back. She gasped, fell forward, and was viciously yanked back upright by Jean, who stood behind her and placed the blade of his hatchet against her throat. Leo Canto, are you all right? With this much pain, Locke gasped, I know I can't be dead. Good enough. Jean applied more force to the hatchet, which he was holding just behind its head, like a barber wielding a beard scraper. Start talking. I can help you die without further pain, or I can even help you live. You're no simple bandit. Who put you here?
My back,
sobbed the woman, her voice trembling and utterly without threat.
Please, please, it hurts.
It's supposed to. Who put you here? Who hired you?
Gold,
said Locke, coughing. White iron. We can pay you. Double. Just give us a name.
Oh, gods, it hurts.
Jean seized her by the hair with his free hand and pulled. She cried out and straightened up. Locke blinked as he saw what appeared to be a dark, feathered shape burst out of her chest. The wet thud of the crossbow quarrel's impact didn't register until a split second later. Jean leapt back, dumbfounded, and dropped the woman to the ground. A moment later, he looked past Locke and gestured threateningly with his hatchet. You!
At your service, Master de Ferrer.
Locke craned his head back far enough to catch an upside-down glimpse of the woman who'd stolen them off the street and delivered them to the Archon a few nights before. Her dark hair fluttered freely behind her in the breeze. She wore a tight black jacket over a grey waistcoat and a grey skirt, and held a discharged crossbow in her left hand. She was walking toward them at a leisurely pace from the direction they'd come. Locke groaned and rolled over until she was right side up. Beside him, the beggar chasseneur gave one last wet cough and died.
"Gods, damn it!" cried Jean. "I was about to get some answers from her!"
"No, you weren't," said the Archon's agent. "Take a look at her right hand."
Locke, climbing shakily to his feet, and Jean both did so. A slender knife with a curved blade glistened there by the faint light of the moons and the few dockside lamps.
"I was assigned to watch over you two," the woman said as she stepped up beside Locke, beaming contentedly.
"Fine fucking job," said Jean, rubbing his ribs with his left hand.
"You seem to be doing well enough until the end."
She looked down at the little knife and nodded.
"Look, this knife has an extra groove right alongside the cutting edge. That usually means something nasty on the blade. She was buying time to slip it out and stick you with it."
"I know what a groove along the blade means,"
mumbled Jean petulantly.
"Do you know who the hell these two work for?"
"I have some theories, yes."
"And would you mind sharing them?" asked Locke.
"If I were given orders to that effect," she said sweetly.
"God's damn all Ferrari and give them more sores on their privates than hairs on their heads," muttered Locke.
"I was born in Velverazzo," said the woman.
"Do you have a name?" asked Jean.
"Lots, all of them lovely and none of them true," she replied. "You two can call me Meraine."
"Meraine. Ow!"
Locke winced and massaged his left forearm with his right hand. Jean set a hand on his shoulder.
"Anything broken, Leo?"
"Not much. Perhaps my dignity and my previous presumptions of divine benevolence." Locke sighed.
"We've seen people following us for the past few nights, Meraine. I suppose we must have seen you."
"I doubt it. You gentlemen should collect your things and start walking. Same direction you were moving before. There'll be constables here soon enough, and the constables don't take orders from my employer."
Locke retrieved his wet stilettos and wiped them on the trousers of the man he'd killed before returning them to his sleeves. Now that the anger of the fight had run cold, Locke felt his gorge rising at the sight of the corpse, and he scuttled away as fast as he could. Jean gathered up his coat and slipped his hatchet into it. Soon enough, the three of them were walking along, Meraine in the middle with her elbows linked in theirs.
"My employer," she said after a few moments, "wished me to watch over you tonight, and when convenient, show you down to a boat."
"Wonderful," said Locke. "Another private conversation."
"I can't say, but if I were to conjecture, I'd guess that he's found a job for the pair of you."
Jean spared a quick glance for the two bodies lying in the darkness far behind them, and he coughed into his clenched fist.
"Splendid," he growled. "This place has been so dull and uncomplicated so far."
Reminiscence. The Amusement War. 1. 6 days north up the coast road from Talvera, the demi-city of Salon-Corbeau lies within an unusually verdant cleft in the black seaside rocks. More than a private estate, not quite a functional village, the demi-city clings to its peculiar life in the smouldering shadow of Mount Azar. In the time of the Therin throne, Azar exploded to life, burying 3 living villages and 10,000 souls in a matter of minutes. These days it seems content merely to rumble and brood, sending twisting charcoal plumes out to sea, and flights of ravens wheel without concern beneath the tired old volcano's smoke. Here begin the hot, dusty plains called the Adra Morcala, inhabited by few and loved by none. They roll like a cracked dry sea all the way to the southern boundaries of Balinel, most westerly and desolate canton of the Kingdom of the Seven Marrows. Locke Lamora rode into Salon-Corbeau on the 9th day of Aurim, in the 78th year of Nara. A mild westerly winter, a fruitful year, and more, had passed since he and Jean had first set foot in Talvera, and in the armoured strongbox at the rear of Locke's rented carriage rattled 1,000 gold solari, stolen at billiards from a certain Lord Landrival of Espara, who was unusually sensitive to lemons. The little harbour that served the demi-city was thick with small craft, yachts and pleasure barges and coasting galleys with square silk sails. Farther out, upon the open sea, a galleon and a sloop rode at anchor, each flying the pennant of Lashane under family crests and colours Locke didn't recognise. The breeze was slight and the sun was pale, more silver than gold behind the hazy exhalations of the mountain.
"Welcome to Salon Corbeau," said a footman in livery of black and olive green, with a tall hat of pressed black felt. "How are you styled, and how must you be announced?"
A liveried woman placed a wooden block beneath the open door to Locke's carriage, and he stepped out, bracing his hands in the small of his back, and stretching with relief before hopping to the ground. He wore a drooping black moustache beneath black-rimmed optics and slick black hair. His heavy black coat was tight in the chest and shoulders, but flared out from waist to knees, fluttering behind him like a cape. He had eschewed the more refined hose and shoes for grey pantaloons tucked into knee-high field boots, dull black beneath a faint layer of road dust.
"I am Mordevai Fairwhite, a merchant of Emberlane," he said. "I doubt that I shall require announcement, as I have no title of any consequence."
"Very good, Master Fairwhite," said the footman smoothly. "The Lady Saljeska appreciates your visit to Salon Corbeau, and earnestly wishes you good fortune in your affairs."
"Appreciates your visit," noted Locke, "rather than would be most pleased to receive your audience. Countess Vera Saljeska of Lashane was the absolute ruler of Salon Corbeau. The demi-city was built on one of her estates, equally distant from Balinel, Talvara, and Lashane, just out of convenient rulership by any of them. Salon Corbeau was more or less an autonomous resort state for the wealthy of the Brass Coast. In addition to the constant arrival of carriages along the coast roads and pleasure vessels from the sea, Salon Corbeau attracted one other noteworthy form of traffic, which Locke had meditated on in a melancholy fashion during his journey. Ragged groups of peasants, urban poor and rural wretches alike, trudged wearily along the dusty roads to Lady Saljeska's domain. They came in intermittent but ceaseless streams, flowing to the strange private city beneath the dark heights of the mountain. Locke imagined that he already knew exactly what they were coming for, but his next few days in Salon Corbeau would prove that understanding to be woefully incomplete. 2. Locke had originally expected that a sea voyage to Lashane or even Isara might be necessary to secure the final pieces of his Sinspire scheme, but conversation with several wealthier Verari had convinced him that Salon Corbeau might have exactly what he needed. Picture a seaside valley carved from night-dark stone, perhaps 300 yards in length and 100 wide. Its little harbour lies on its western side, with a crescent beach of fine black sand. At its eastern end, an underground stream pours out of a fissure in the rocks, rushing down a stepped arrangement of stones. The headlands above this stream are commanded by Countess Saljeska's residence, a stone manor house above two layers of crenellated walls, a minor fortress. The valley walls of Salon Corbeau are perhaps 20 yards in height, and for nearly their full length they are terraced with gardens. Thick ferns, twisting vines, blossoming orchids, and fruit and olive trees flourish there, a healthy curtain of brown and green in vivid relief against the black, with little water ducts meandering throughout to keep Saljeska's artificial paradise from growing thirsty. In the very centre of the valley is a circular stadium, and the gardens on both sides of this stone structure share the walls with several dozen sturdy buildings of polished stone and lacquered wood. A miniature city rests on stilts and platforms and terraces, charmingly enclosed by walkways and stairs at every level. Locke strolled these walkways on the afternoon of his arrival, looking for his ultimate goal with a stately lack of haste. He expected to be here for many days, perhaps even weeks. Salon Corbeau, like the chance houses of Tal Verar, drew the idle rich in large numbers. Locke walked among Verari merchants and Lashani nobles, among scions of the Western Marrows, past Nessi ladies-in-waiting, or perhaps more accurately, ladies-weighted down, in more cloth of gold than Locke would have previously thought possible, and the landed families they served. Here and there he was sure he even spotted Kamori, olive-skinned and haughty, though thankfully none were important enough for him to recognize. So many bodyguards, and so many bodies to guard. Rich bodies and faces, people who could afford proper alchemy and physic for their ailments. No weeping sores or sagging facial tumors, no crooked teeth lolling out of bleeding gums, no faces pinched by emaciation. The Sinspire crowd might be more exclusive, but these folk were even more refined, even more pampered. Hired musicians followed some of them, so that even little journeys of 30 or 40 yards need not threaten a second of boredom. Rich men and women were hemorrhaging money all around Locke to the strains of music. Even a man like Mordavi Fairwhite might spend less to eat for a month than some of them would throw away just to be noticed at breakfast each day. He'd come to Salon Corbeau because of these folk, not to rob them for once, but to make use of their privileged existence. Where the rich nested like bright-feathered birds, the providers of the luxuries and services they relied upon followed. Salon Corbeau had a permanent community of tailors, clothiers, instrument-makers, glass-benders, alchemists, caterers, entertainers, and carpenters. A small community, to be sure, but one of the highest reputation, fit for aristocratic patronage and priced accordingly. Almost in the middle of Salon Corbeau's south gallery, Locke found the shop he had come all this way to visit, a rather long, two-story stone building without windows along its walkway face. The wooden sign above the single door said, "Monsieur Beaumondaine and Daughters, Household Devices and Fine Furniture by Appointment." On the door of the Beaumondaine shop was a scrollwork decoration, the crest of the Salgeska family, as Locke had glimpsed on banners fluttering here and there, and on the cross-belts of Salon Corbeau's guards, implying Lady Vera's personal approval of the work that went on there, meaningless to Locke, since he knew too little of Salgeska's taste to judge it. But the Beaumondaine reputation stretched all the way to Tal Verar. He would send a messenger first thing in the morning, as was appropriate, and request an appointment to discuss the matter of some peculiar chairs he needed built. 3. At the second hour of the next afternoon, a warm, soft rain was falling, a weak and wispy thing that hung in the air more like damp gauze than falling water. Vague columns of mist swirled among the plants and atop the valley, and the walkways were for once clear of most of their well-heeled traffic. Grey clouds necklaced the tall black mountain to the northwest. Locke stood outside the door to the Beaumondaine shop with water dripping down the back of his neck, and rapped sharply 3 times. The door swung inward immediately. A wiry man of about 50 peered out at Locke through round optics. He wore a simple cotton tunic cinched up above his elbows, revealing guild tattoos in faded green and black on his lean forearms, and a long leather apron with at least 6 visible pockets on the front. Most of them held tools. One held a grey kitten, with only its little head visible.
"Master Fairwhite? Mordavi Fairwhite?"
"So pleased you could make the time for me," began Locke. He spoke with a faint Vadran accent, just enough to suggest an origin in the far north. He'd decided to be lazy, and let this Fairwhite be as fluent in Therin as possible. Locke stretched out his right hand to shake. In his left he carried a black leather satchel with an iron lock upon its flap.
Master Beaumondaine, I presume?
None other. Come in directly, sir, out of the rain. Will you take coffee? Allow me to trade you a cup for your coat.
With pleasure.
The foyer of the Beaumondaine shop was a high, cosily panelled room lit with little golden lanterns in wall sconces. A counter with one swinging door ran across the rear of the room, and behind it Locke could see shelves piled high with samples of wood, cloth, wax, and oils in glass jars. The place smelled of sanded wood, a sharp and pleasant tang. There was a little sitting area before the counter, where two superbly wrought chairs with black velvet cushions stood upon a floor tapestry. Locke set his satchel at his feet, turned to allow Beaumondaine to help him shrug out of his damp black coat, picked up his satchel once again, and settled himself in the chair nearest to the door. The carpenter hung Locke's coat on a brass hook on the wall.
"Just a moment, if you please," he said, and went behind the counter.
From his new vantage point, Locke could see that a canvas-covered door led from behind the counter to what he presumed must be the workshop. Beaumondaine pushed the canvas flap aside and yelled,
"Loris, the coffee!"
Some muffled reply that he evidently found satisfactory came back to him from the workshop, and he hurried around the counter to take his place in the chair across from Locke, crinkling his seamy face into a welcoming smile. A few moments later, the canvas flew aside once again, and out from the workshop came a freckled girl of 15 or 16 years, chestnut-haired, slim in the manner of her father, but more firmly muscled about the arms and shoulders. She carried a wooden tray before her, set with cups and silver pots, and when she stepped through the door in the counter, Locke saw the tray had legs like a very short table. She placed the coffee service between Locke and her father, just to the side, and gave Locke a respectful nod.
"My oldest daughter, Loris," said Master Beaumondaine. "Loris, this is Master Fairwhite of the House of Bell Sarathon from Emberlane."
"Charmed," said Locke.
Loris was close enough for him to see that her hair was full of curly little wood shavings.
"Your servant, Master Fairwhite."
Loris nodded again, prepared to withdraw, and then caught sight of the grey kitten sticking out of her father's apron pocket.
"Father, you've forgotten Lively. Surely you didn't mean to have him sit in on the coffee?" "Have I? Oh, dear, I see that I have."
Beaumondaine reached down and eased the kitten out of his apron. Locke was astonished to see how limply it hung in his hands, with its legs and tail drooping and its little head lolling. What self-respecting cat would sleep while plucked up and carried through the air? Then Locke saw the answer, as Loris took Lively in her own hands and turned to go. The kitten's little eyes were wide open and stark white.
"That creature was gentled," said Locke in a low voice when Loris had returned to the workshop.
"I'm afraid so," said the carpenter.
"I've never seen such a thing. What purpose does it serve in a cat?"
"None, Master Fairwhite, none."
Beaumondaine's smile was gone, replaced by a wary and uncomfortable expression.
"And it certainly wasn't my doing. My youngest daughter, Parnella, found him abandoned behind the Villa Verdante."
Beaumondaine referred to the huge luxury inn where the intermediate class of Salon Corbeau's visitors stayed, the wealthy who were not private guests of the Lady Salgesca. Locke himself was rooming there.
"Damned strange."
"We call him Lively as a sort of jest, though he does little. He must be coaxed to eat and prodded to excrete, you see. Parnella thought it would be kinder to smash his skull, but Loris would not hear of it, and so I could not refuse. You must think me weak and doting."
"Not at all," said Locke, shaking his head. "The world is cruel enough without our compounding it. I approve. I meant that it was damned strange that anyone should do such a thing at all."
"Master Fairwhite," the carpenter licked his lips nervously, "you seem a humane man, and you must understand,
Our position here brings us a steady and lucrative business. My daughters will have quite an inheritance when I turn this shop over to them. There are things about Salon Corbeau, things that go on, that we artisans do not pry into, must not, if you take my meaning.
I do, said Locke, eager to keep the man in a good humour. However, he made a mental note to perhaps poke around in pursuit of whatever was disturbing the carpenter. I do indeed. So let us speak no more of the matter, and instead look to business.
Most kind, said Beaumondaine, with obvious relief. How do you take your coffee? I have honey and cream.
Honey, please. Beaumondaine poured steaming coffee from the silver pot into a thick glass cup, and spooned in honey until Locke nodded. Locke sipped at his cup while Beaumondaine bombarded his own with enough cream to turn it leather brown. It was quality brew, rich and very hot.
My compliments, Locke mumbled over a slightly scalded tongue.
It's from Isara. Lady Salgeska's household has an endless thirst for the stuff, said the carpenter. The rest of us buy pecks and pinches from her cellars when they come around. Now, your messenger said that you wished to discuss a commission that was, in her words, very particular.
Yes, indeed, said Locke. Particular to a design and an end that may strike you as eccentric. I assure you, I am in grave earnest. Locke set down his coffee and lifted his satchel into his lap, then pulled a small key from his waistcoat pocket to open the lock. He reached inside and drew out a few pieces of folded parchment.
You must be familiar, Locke continued, with the style of the last few years of the Therin throne. The very last few, just before Talathri died in battle against the Bonds Magi.
He passed over one of his sheets of parchment, which Beaumondaine removed his optics to examine.
Oh, yes, the carpenter said slowly. The Talathri Baroque, also called the Last Flowering. Yes, I've done pieces in this fashion before. Loris has as well. You have an interest in this style?
I require a suite of chairs, said Locke. Four of them, leather-backed, lacquered sheer crescent with real gold insets.
Sheer crescent is a somewhat delicate wood, fit only for occasional use. For more regular sitting, I'm sure you'd want witchwood.
My master, said Locke, has very exact tastes, however peculiar. He insisted upon sheer crescent several times to ensure that his wishes were clear.
Well, if you wished them carved from marzipan, I suppose I should have to do it. With the clear understanding, of course, that I did warn you against hard use.
Naturally. I assure you, Master Beaumondaine, you won't be held liable for anything that happens to these chairs after they leave your workshop.
Oh, I would never do less than vouch for our work, but I cannot make a soft wood hard, Master Fairwhite. Well, then, I do have some books with excellent illustrations of this style. Your artist has done well to start with, but I'd like to give you more variety to choose from.
By all means, said Locke, and he sipped his coffee contentedly as the carpenter rose and returned to the workshop door.
Loris, Beaumondaine cried, my three volumes of Vellonetta. Yes, those.
He returned a moment later cradling three heavy leather-bound tomes that smelled of age and some spicy alchemical preservative.
Vellonetta, he said as he settled the books on his lap. You are familiar with her? No? She was the foremost scholar of the Last Flowering. There are only 6 sets of her work in all the world, as far as I know. Most of these pages are on sculpture, painting, music, alchemy. But there are fine passages on furniture, gems worth mining. If you please.
They spent half an hour poring over the sketches Locke had provided and the pages Beaumondaine wished to show him. Together they hammered out an agreeable compromise on the design of the chairs that Master Fairwhite would receive. Beaumondaine fetched a stylus of his own and scrawled notes in an illegible chicken scratch. Locke had never before considered how many details might go into something as straightforward as a chair. By the time they had finished their discussion of legs, bracings, cushion fillings, leathers, scrollwork and joinery, Locke's brain was in full revolt. "Excellent, Master Beaumondaine, excellent," is nonetheless what he said. "The very thing, in sheer crescent, lacquered black, with gold leaf to gild the incised decorations and the rivets. They must look as though they had been plucked from Emperor Talathri's court just yesterday, new and unburnt."
"Ah," said the carpenter, "a delicate subject arises then. Without meaning to give the slightest offence, I must make it clear that these will never pass for originals. They will be exact reconstructions of the style, perfect facsimiles of a quality to match any furnishings in the world, but an expert could tell. They are few and far between, but such a one would never confuse a brilliant reconstruction for even a modest original. They have had centuries to weather. These will be plainly new."
"I take your meaning, Master Beaumondaine. Never fear. I am ordering these for eccentric purposes, not for deceptive ones. These chairs will never be alleged to be originals, on my word. And the man who will receive them is such an expert, in fact."
"Very good, then, very good. Is there anything else?"
"Yes," said Locke, who had withheld two sketch-covered sheets of parchment and passed them over. "Now that we've settled on a design for the suite of chairs, this, or something very much like it, subject to your more expert adjustments, must be included in the plans." As Beaumondaine absorbed the implications of the sketches, his eyebrows rose steadily, until it seemed that they were being drawn up to the fullest possible extent of his forehead's suppleness, and must be flung back down to the floor like crossbow bolts when they reached their zenith.
"This is a prodigious curiosity," he said at last. "A very strange thing to incorporate. I'm not at all sure..."
"It is essential," said Locke. "That, or something very much like it, within the bounds of your own discretion. It is absolutely necessary. My master simply will not place an order for the chairs unless these features are built into them. Cost is no object."
"It's possible," said the carpenter, after a few seconds of further contemplation. "Possible, with some adjustment to these designs. I believe I see your intention, but I can improve upon this scheme. Must, if the chairs are to function as chairs. May I ask why this is necessary?"
"My master is a dear old fellow, but as you must have gathered, quite eccentric and morbidly afraid of fire. He fears to be trapped in his study or his library tower by flames. Surely you can see how these mechanisms might help set his mind at ease."
"I suppose I can,"
muttered Beaumondaine, his puzzled reluctance turning to interest in a professional challenge as he spoke. After that, it was merely a matter of haggling, however politely, over finer and finer details, until Locke was finally able to coax a suggested price out of Beaumondaine.
"What coin would you wish to settle in, Master Fairwhite?"
"I presumed solari would be convenient."
"Shall we say 6 solari per chair?"
Beaumondaine spoke with feigned nonchalance. That was a cheeky initial offer, even for luxury craftsmanship. Locke would be expected to haggle it down. Instead, he smiled and nodded. "If 6 per chair is what you require, then 6 you will have."
"Oh,"
said Beaumondaine, almost too surprised to be pleased.
"Oh, well then, I should be only too happy to accept your note."
"While that would be fine in ordinary circumstances, let's do something more convenient for both of us." Locke reached inside the satchel and drew out a coin purse, from which he counted 24 gold solari onto the little coffee table, while Beaumondaine watched with growing excitement. "There you are, in advance. I prefer to carry hard coinage when I come to Salon Corbeau. This little city needs a moneylender."
"Well, thank you, Master Fairwhite, thank you. I didn't expect... Well, let me get a work order and some papers for you to take with you, and we'll be set."
"Now let me ask, do you have all the materials you need for my master's order?"
"Oh, yes, I know that off the top of my head."
"Warehoused here at your shop?"
"Yes, indeed, Master Fairwhite."
"About how long might I expect the construction to take?"
Given my other duties and your requirements, 6 weeks, possibly 7. Will you be returning for them yourself, or will we need to arrange shipping?"
"In that, too, I was hoping for something a little more convenient."
"Ah, well, you have been so very civil, I'm sure I could shift my schedule. 5 weeks, perhaps?"
"Master Beaumondaine, if you and your daughters were to work on my master's order more or less exclusively, starting this afternoon at your best possible speed, how long then would you say it might take?"
"Oh, Master Fairwhite, you must understand, I have other orders pending for clients of some standing. Significant people, if you take my meaning."
Locke set 4 more gold coins atop the coffee table.
"Master Fairwhite, be reasonable. These are just chairs. I will bend every effort to finishing your order as fast as possible, but I cannot simply displace my existing clients or their pieces."
Locke set 4 more coins down next to the previous pile.
"Master Fairwhite, please, we would give you our exclusive efforts for far less, if only we didn't already have clients to satisfy. How could I possibly explain this to them?"
Locke set 6 more coins directly in the middle of the 2 stacks of 4, building a little tower. "What is that now, Beaumondaine? 40 solari, when you were so pleased to get just 24?
"Sir, please, my sole consideration is that clients who placed their orders before your master's must, in all courtesy, have precedence."
Locke sighed and dumped 10 more solari onto the coffee table, upsetting his little tower and emptying the purse. "You can have a shortage of materials, some essential wood or oil or leather. You need to send away for it. 6 days to Talvara and 6 days back. Surely it's happened before. Surely you can explain."
"Oh, but the aggravation! They'll be so annoyed!"
Locke drew a 2nd coin purse from his satchel and held it poised like a dagger in the air before him. "Refund some of their money. Here, have more of mine." He shook out even more coins haphazardly. The clink, clink, clink of metal falling upon metal echoed in the foyer.
"Master Fairwhite," said the carpenter, "who are you?"
"A man who's dead serious about chairs." Locke dropped the half-full purse atop the pile of gold next to the coffee pot. 100 solari, even. Put off your other appointments, set aside your other jobs, make your excuses and your refunds. How long would it take?"
"Perhaps a week,"
said Beaumondaine in a defeated whisper. "Then you agree? Until my 4 chairs are finished, this is the Fairwhite Furniture Shop? I have more gold in the Villa Verdante's strongbox. You will have to kill me to stop forcing it upon you if you say no. So do we have a deal?"
"Gods help us both, yes."
"Then shake on it. You get carving, and I'll start wasting time back at my inn. Send messengers if you need me to inspect anything. I'll stay until you're finished." 4. As you can see, my hands are empty. and it is unthinkable that anything should be concealed within the sleeves of such a finely tailored tunic. Locke stood before the full-length mirror in his suite at the Villa Verdante, wearing nothing but his breeches and a light tunic of fine silk. The cuffs of the tunic were drawn away from his wrists, and he stared intently at his own reflection. "It would, of course, be impossible for me to produce a deck of cards from thin air. But what's this?" He moved his right hand toward the mirror with a flourish, and a deck of cards slipped clumsily out of it, coming apart in a fluttering mess as it fell to the floor. "Oh, fucking hell," Locke muttered. He had a week of empty time on his hands, and his legerdemain was improving with torturous slowness. Locke soon turned his attention to the curious institution at the heart of Salon Corbeau, the reason so many idle rich made pilgrimage to the place, and the reason so many desperate and downtrodden ate their carriage dust as they trudged to the same destination. They called it the Amusement War. Lady Selgeska's stadium was a miniature of the legendary Stadia Ultra of Therimpel, complete with 12 marble idols of the gods gracing the exterior in high stone niches. Ravens perched on their divine heads and shoulders, cawing half-heartedly down at the bustling crowd around the gates. As he made his way through the tumult, Locke noted every species of attendant known to man. There were physicians clucking over the elderly, litter-bearers hauling the infirm or the unabashedly lazy, musicians and jugglers, guards, translators, and dozens of men and women waving fans or hoisting wide silk parasols, looking like nothing so much as fragile human-sized mushrooms as they chased their patrons under the growing morning sun. While it was said that the floor of the Imperial Arena had been too wide for even the strongest archer to send an arrow across, the floor of Selgeska's recreation was just 50 yards in diameter. There were no common seats. The smooth stone walls rose 20 feet above the smooth stone floor, and were topped with luxury galleries whose cloth sunscreens flapped gently in the breeze. 3 times per day, Lady Selgeska's liveried guards would open the public gates to the better class of Salon Corbeau's visitors. There was a single standing gallery, which even had a decent view, to which admission was free, but the vast majority of spectators at the stadium would take nothing less than the luxury seats and boxes, which needed to be reserved at some considerable expense. Unfashionable as it was, Locke elected to stand for his first visit to the Amusement War. A relative nonentity like Mordavi Fairwhite had no reputation to protect. On the floor of the arena was a gleaming grid of black and white marble squares, each 1 yard on a side. The squares were set 20 by 20, like a gigantic catch-the-duke board. Where little carved pieces of wood or ivory were used in that game, Selgeska's playing field featured living pieces. The poor and destitute would man that field, 40 to a side, wearing white or black tabards to distinguish themselves. This strange employment was the reason they risked the long, hard trudge to Salon Corbeau. Locke had already discovered that there were 2 large barracks behind Lady Selgeska's stadium, heavily guarded, where the poor were taken upon arrival in Salon Corbeau. There they were made to clean themselves up, and were given 2 simple meals a day for the duration of their stay, which could be indefinite. Each aspirant, as they were known, was assigned a number. 3 times per day, random drawings were held to select 2 teams of 40 for the coming amusement war. The only rule of the war was that the living pieces had to be able to stand, move, and obey orders. Children of 8 or 9 were about the youngest taken. Those who refused to participate when their number was drawn, even once, were thrown out of Selgeska's demi-city immediately and barred from returning. Without supplies and preparation, being cast out onto the roads in this dry land could be a death sentence. The aspirants were marched into the arena by 2 dozen of Selgeska's guards, who were armed with curved shields and lacquered wooden sticks. They were robust men and women who moved with the easy assurance of hard experience. Even a general uprising of the aspirants would stand no chance against them. The guards lined the aspirants up in their starting positions on the board, 40 white pieces and 40 black pieces, with 16 squares separating each double-ranked army. At opposite ends of the stadium were two special gallery boxes, one draped in black silk curtains and the other in white. These boxes were reserved far in advance by a waiting list, much as patrons of a chance house would lay claim to billiards tables or private rooms at certain hours. Whoever reserved a box gained the right to absolute command of that colour for the duration of a war. That morning's white war mistress was a young Lashani Viscountess, whose retinue looked as nervous with the affair as she was enthusiastic. They appeared to be scribbling notes and consulting charts. The black war master was a middle-aged Iridani, with the well-fed, calculating look of a prosperous merchant. He had a young son and daughter with him in his gallery. Although the living pieces could be hung, by the agreement of both players, with special tabards that gave them unusual privileges or movement allowances, the rules of this particular amusement war seemed to be plain catch the duke with no variations. The controllers began calling orders, and the game slowly developed, with white and black pieces trudging nervously toward one another, very gradually closing the distance between the opposing forces. Locke found himself puzzled by the reaction of the stadium crowd. There were easily 60 or 70 spectators in the boxes, with twice as many servants, bodyguards, assistants, and messengers on hand, not to mention caterers in Salgeska's livery hurrying to and fro to serve their wants. Their buzz of eager anticipation seemed totally incongruous, given the plodding nature of the contest shaping up on the square. "What?" Locke muttered to himself in Vajran, "is so damn fascinating." Then the first piece was taken, and the demons came out to the arena floor. The white war mistress deliberately placed one of her pieces, a middle-aged man, in harm's way. More of her army lurked behind him in an obvious trap, but the black war master apparently decided it was a worthwhile exchange. Under the shouted orders of the black adjutant, a teenaged girl in black stepped from a diagonal square and touched the middle-aged man on the shoulder. He hung his head, and the appreciative clapping of the crowd was drowned out a moment later by a wild shrieking that arose from the far left side of Locke's view of the stadium. 6 men ran onto the arena floor from a side portal, dressed in elaborate leather costumes with black and orange fluting. Their faces were covered with grotesque flame-orange masks, trailing wild manes of black hair. They threw their arms in the air, screaming and hollering meaninglessly, and the crowd cheered back as they ran across the arena toward the cringing man in white. The demons seized him by the arms and by the hair. He was thrust, sobbing, to the side of the game board and exhibited to the crowd like a sacrificial animal. One of the demons, a man with a booming voice, pointed to the black war master and shouted, "Cry the default!"
"I want to cry it," said the little boy in the merchant's gallery.
"We agreed that your sister would go first. Theodora, name the default." The little girl peered down to the arena floor in concentration, then whispered up to her father. He cleared his throat and shouted, "She wants the guards to beat him with their clubs, on his legs." And so it was. The demons held the writhing, screaming man with his limbs spread, while 2 guards obligingly laid into him. The fall of their sticks echoed across the arena. They thoroughly bruised his thighs, shins, and calves until the chief demon waved his hands to clear them off. The audience applauded politely, though not with particular enthusiasm, noted Locke, and the demons hauled the quivering, bleeding man off the stadium floor. They came back soon enough. One of the whites removed a black on the next move. "Cry the default!" echoed once again across the arena.
"I'll sell the right for 5 solari," shouted the Lashani Viscountess. "First taker."
"I'll pay it,"
cried an old man in the stands, dressed in layers of velvet and cloth of gold. The chief demon pointed up at him, and he beckoned to a frock-coated attendant standing just behind him. The attendant threw a purse down to one of Selgeska's guards, who carried it over to the white war mistress's side of the field and threw it into her gallery. The demons then hauled the young woman in black over for the old man's examination. After a moment of exaggerated contemplation, he shouted,
"Get rid of her dress!"
The young woman's black tabard and dirty cotton dress were ripped apart by the grasping hands of the demons. In seconds, she was naked. She seemed determined to give less of a demonstration than the man who'd gone before. She glared stonily up at the old man, be he minor lord or merchant prince, and said nothing.
"Is that all?" cried the chief demon. "Oh, no," said the old man. "Get rid of her hair, too!"
The crowd burst into applause and cheers at that, and the woman betrayed real fear for the first time. She had a thick mane of glossy black hair down to the small of her back, something to be proud of even among the penniless, perhaps all she had to be proud of in the world. The chief demon played to the crowd, hoisting a gleaming, crooked dagger over his head and howling with glee. The woman attempted to struggle against the five pairs of arms that held her, to no avail. Swiftly, painfully, the chief demon slashed at her long black locks. They fluttered down until the ground was thick with them, and the woman's scalp was covered with nothing but a chopped, irregular stubble. Trickles of blood ran down her face and neck as she was dragged, too numb for further struggle, out of the arena. So it went, as Locke watched in growing unease, as the pitiless sun crept across the sky and the shadows shortened. The living pieces moved on the gleaming hot squares without water and without relief, until they were taken from the board and subjected to a default of the opposing war master's choosing. It soon became apparent to Locke that the default could be virtually anything short of death. The demons would follow orders with frenzied enthusiasm, playing up each new injury or humiliation for the appreciative crowd. Gods, Locke realized, barely any of them are here for the game at all. They've only come to see the defaults. The rows of armored guards would dissuade all possibility of refusal or rebellion. Those pieces who refused to hurry along to their appointed places or dared to step off their squares without instructions were simply beaten until they obeyed. Obey they did, and the cruelty of the defaults did not wane as the game went on.
"Rotten fruit!"
the little boy in the black war master's box yelled, and so it was. An elderly woman with a white tabard was thrown against the stadium wall and pelted with apples, pears, and tomatoes by four of the demons. They knocked her off her feet and continued the barrage until the woman was a shuddering heap, curled up beneath her frail arms for protection, and great spatters of sour pulp and juice were dripping from the wall behind her. The white player's retaliation was swift. She took a stocky young man in black colours and for once reserved the choice of default to herself.
"We must keep our hostess stadium clean. Take him to the wall with the fruit stains," she shouted, "and let him clean it with his tongue."
The crowd broke into wild applause at that. The man on the arena floor was pushed up to the wall by the chief demon.
"Start licking, scum!"
His first efforts were half-hearted. Another demon produced a whip that ended in seven knotted cords and lashed the man across the shoulders, knocking him into the wall hard enough to bloody his nose.
"Earn your fucking pay, worm!"
screamed the demon, whipping him once again.
"Haven't you ever had a lady tell you to get down and use your tongue before?"
The man ran his tongue desperately up and down the wall, gagging every few seconds, which would bring another crack of the demon's whip. The man was a bleeding, retching, nervous wreck by the time he was finally hauled from the arena floor. So it went, all morning long. Gods, why do they bear it? Why do they take this? Locke stood in the free gallery alone, staring out at the wealthy and powerful, at their guards and servants, and at the thinning ranks of the living pieces in the game beneath them. He brooded, sweating in his heavy black garments. Here were the richest and freest people in the Therin world, those with positions and money but no political duties to constrict them, gathered together to do what law and custom forbade beyond Saljeska's private fiefdom, to humiliate and brutalize their lessers however they saw fit for their own gleeful amusement. The arena and the amusement war itself were obviously just frames, means to an end. There was no order to it, no justice. Gladiators and prisoners fighting before a crowd were there for a reason, risking their lives for glory or paying the price for having been caught. Men and women hung from a gibbets because the crooked warden had only so much help to give to the foolish, the slow, and the unlucky. But this was wanton. Locke felt his anger growing like a canker in his guts. They had no idea who he was or what he was really capable of. No idea what the Thorn of Camor could do to them, unleashed on Salon Corbeau, with Jean to aid him. Given months to plan and observe, the gentleman bastards could take the place apart, find ways to cheat the amusement war, surely. Rob the participants, rob the Lady Saljeska, embarrass and humiliate the bastards, blacken the demi-city's reputation so thoroughly that nobody would ever want to visit again. But...
Crooked Warden, Locke whispered. Why now? Why show me this now?
Jean was waiting for him back in Tal Varrar, and they were already neck-deep in a game that had taken a year to put together. Jean didn't know anything about what really went on at Salon Corbeau. He would be expecting Locke to return in short order with a set of chairs, so the two of them could carry on with the plan they'd agreed to, a plan that was already desperately delicate.
"Gods damn it," said Locke. "Gods damn it all to hell."
5. Camor, years before, the wet, seeping mists enclosed Locke and Father Chains in curtains of midnight grey as the old man led the boy back home from his first meeting with Capa Vencarlo Barsavi. Locke, drunk and sweat-soaked, clung to the back of his gentled goat for dear life.
"You don't belong to Barsavi," Chains said. "He's good enough for what he is, a good ally to have on your side, and a man that you must appear to obey at all times. But he certainly doesn't own you. In the end, neither do I."
"So I don't have to..."
"Obey the secret peace, be a good little peasant, only for pretend, Locke, only to keep the wolves from the door. Unless your eyes and ears have been stitched shut with rawhide these past 2 days, by now you must have realized that I intend you and Carlo and Galdo and Sabatha to be nothing less," Chains confided through a feral grin, "than a fucking ballista bolt right through the heart of Vencarlo's precious secret peace."
Locke collected his thoughts for several moments. "Why?"
"It's complicated. It has to do with what I am and what I hope you'll someday be. A priest in the sworn service of the Crooked Warden."
"Is the Kappa doing something wrong?"
"Well," said Chains, "well, lad, now there's a question. Is he doing right by the right people? Gods, yes. The secret peace tames the city watch, calms everyone down, gets less of us hung. Still, every priesthood has what we call mandates, laws handed down by the gods themselves to those who serve them. In most temples, these are complex, messy, annoying things. In the priesthood of the benefactor, things are easy. We only have 2. The first one is thieves prosper. Simple as that. We're ordered to aid one another, hide one another, make peace whenever possible, and see to it that our kind flourishes, by hook or by crook. Barsavi's got that mandate covered. Never doubt that. But the second mandate
said Chains, lowering his voice and glancing around into the fog to make doubly sure that they were not overheard. "Is this the rich remember?"
"Remember what?"
"That they're not invincible, that locks can be picked and treasures can be stolen. Nara, mistress of ubiquitous maladies, may her hand be stayed, sends disease among men so that men will never forget that they are not gods. We're sort of like that for the rich and powerful. Wear the stone in their shoe, the thorn in their side, a little bit of reciprocity this side of divine judgment. That's our second mandate, and it's as important as the first."
"And the secret peace protects the nobles, and so you don't like it?"
"It's not that I don't like it." Chains mulled his next few words over before he let them out. "Barsavi's not a priest of the 13th. He's not sworn to the mandates like I am. He's got to be practical. And while I can accept that, I can't just let it go. It's my divine duty to see that the blue bloods with their pretty titles get a little bit of what life hands the rest of us as a matter of routine. A nice sharp jab in the ass every now and again."
"And Barsavi doesn't need to know about this?"
"Bleeding shits, no. As I see it, if Barsavi takes care of thieves prosper, and I look after the rich remember, this'll be one holy, holy city in the eyes of the crooked warden."
6. "Why do they bear it? I know they get paid, but the defaults, gods, holy marrows, why do they come here and put up with it? Humiliated, beaten, stoned, befouled? To what end?"
Locke paced agitatedly around the Beaumondaine family's workshop, clenching and unclenching his fists. It was the afternoon of his fourth day in Salon Corbeau.
"As you said, they get paid, Master Fairwhite."
Loris Beaumondaine rested one hand gently on the back of the half-finished chair Locke had come in to see. With the other she stroked poor motionless Lively, tucked away inside a pocket of her apron.
"If you're selected for a game, you get a copper centira. If you're given a default, you get a silver volani. There's also a random drawing. One person per war, one in 80, gets a gold solari."
"They must be desperate," said Locke.
"Farms fail, businesses fail, tenant lands get repossessed, plagues knock all the money and health out of cities. When they've got nowhere else to come, they come here. There's a roof to sleep under, meals, hope of gold or silver. All you have to do is go out there often enough and amuse them."
"It's perverse. It's infamous."
"You have a soft heart for what you're spending on just four chairs, Master Fairwhite."
Loris looked down and wrung her hands together.
"Forgive me. I spoke well out of turn."
"Speak as you will. I am not a rich man, Loris. I'm just my master's servant. But even he... we're frugal people, damn it. Frugal and fair. We might be eccentric, but we're not cruel."
"I've seen nobles from the marrows at the amusement war many times, Master Fairwhite."
"We're not nobles. We're merchants. Merchants of Emberlane. I can't speak for our nobles, and often don't want to. Look, I've seen many cities. I know how people live. I've seen gladiatorial fights, executions, misery and poverty and desperation, but I've never seen anything like that. The faces of those spectators, the way they watched and cheered, like jackals, like crows, like something so very wrong."
"There are no laws here but Lady Seljeska's laws," said Loris. "Here they can behave however they choose. At the amusement war they can do exactly what they want to do to the poor folk and the simple folk. Things forbidden elsewhere. All you're seeing is what they look like when they stop pretending they give a damn about anything. Where do you think Lively came from?
I saw a noblewoman having kittens gentled so her sons could torture them with knives, because they were bored at tea. So welcome to Salon Corbeau, Master Fairwhite. I'm sorry it's not the paradise it looks like from a distance. Does our work on the chairs meet with your approval?
Yes, said Locke slowly. Yes, I suppose it does.
If I were to presume to give you advice, said Loris, I'd suggest that you stay away from the amusement war for the rest of your stay. Do what the rest of us here do. Ignore it. Paint a great cloud of fog over it in your mind's eye and pretend that it's not there.
As you say, Madame Beaumondaine, Locke sighed. I might just do so. 7. But Locke could not stay away. Morning, afternoon, and evening, he found himself in the public gallery, standing alone, eating and drinking nothing. He saw crowd after crowd, war after war, humiliation after humiliation. The demons made gruesome mistakes on several occasions. Beatings and stranglings got out of control. Those aspirants who were accidentally roughed up beyond hope of recovery had their skulls crushed on the spot, to the polite applause of the crowd. It would not do to be unmerciful. "Crooked warden," Locke muttered to himself the first time it happened. "They don't even have a priest, not a single one." He realized dimly what he was doing to himself. He felt the stirring within, as though his conscience were a deep, still lake with a beast struggling to rise to its surface. Each brutal humiliation, each painful default, excitedly decreed by some spoiled noble child, while their parents laughed in appreciation, gave strength to that beast as it beat itself against his better judgment, his cold calculation, his willingness to stick to the plan. He was trying to make himself angry enough to give in. The Thorn of Camor had been a mask he'd half-heartedly worn as a game. Now it was almost a separate entity, a hungry thing, an increasingly insistent ghost prying at his resolve to stand up for the mandate of his faith. "Let me out," it whispered. "Let me out. The rich must remember. By the gods, I can make damn sure they never forget." "I hope you'll pardon my intrusion if I observe that you don't seem to be enjoying yourself." Locke was snapped out of his brooding by the appearance of another man in the free gallery. The stranger was tanned and fit-looking, perhaps 5 or 6 years older than Locke, with brown curls down to his collar and a precisely trimmed goatee. His long velvet coat was lined with cloth of silver, and he held a gold-topped cane behind his back with both hands. "But forgive me. Fernand Genrusa, peer of the third of Lachaine." Peer of the third order, a baron, a purchased Lachani patent of nobility, just as Locke and Jean had toyed with possibly acquiring. Locke bent slightly at the waist and inclined his head. "Mordavi Fairwhite, my lord, of Emberlane." "A merchant, then. You must be doing well for yourself, Master Fairwhite, to take your leisure here. So what's behind your long face? What makes you think I'm displeased?" "You stand here alone, taking no refreshment, and you watch each new war with such an expression on your face, as though someone was slipping hot coals into your breech clout. I've seen you several times from my own gallery. Are you losing money? I might be able to share some insights I've cultivated on how to best place wagers at the amusement war."
"I have no wagers outstanding, my lord. I'm merely unable to stop watching."
"Curious. Yet it does not please you."
"No."
Locke turned slightly toward Baron Genrusa and swallowed nervously. Etiquette demanded that a lowborn like Mordavi Fairwhite, and a Vadran at that, should defer even to a banknote baron like Genrusa and offer no unpleasant conversation, but Genrusa seemed to be inviting explanation. Locke wondered how much he might get away with.
Have you ever seen a carriage accident, my lord, or a man run over by a team of horses, seen the blood and wreckage, and been completely unable to take your eyes off the spectacle?
I can't say that I have.
There I would beg to differ. You have a private gallery to see it 3 times a day if you wish, my lord.
Ah, so you find the amusement war, what, undecorous?
Cruel, my lord Genrusa, most uncommonly cruel.
Cruel? Compared to what? War? Times of plague?
Have you ever seen Camor, by chance? Now there's a basis for comparison that might have you thinking more soundly, Master Fairwhite.
Even in Camor, said Locke, I don't believe anyone is allowed to beat old women in broad daylight on a whim, or tear their clothes off, stone them, rape them, slash their hair off, splash them with alchemical caustics. It's like children tearing off an insect's wings, so they might watch and laugh.
Who forced them to come here, Fairwhite? Who put a sword to their backs and made them march all the way to Salon Corbeau along those hot, empty roads? That pilgrimage takes days from anywhere worthy of note.
What choice do they have, my lord? They're only here because they're desperate, because they could not sustain themselves where they were. Farms fail, businesses fail. It's desperation is all. They cannot simply decide not to eat.
Farms fail, businesses fail, ships sink, empires fall. Genrusa brought his cane out from behind his back and punctuated his statements by gesturing at Locke with the gold head.
That's life under the gods, by the will of the gods. Perhaps if they'd prayed harder, or saved more, or been less thoughtless with what they had, they wouldn't need